It's a real privilege for me to have this opportunity to introduce the very first panel of the day. And I was very mindful when I was writing this that without this first panel, we perhaps wouldn't be here 50 years on. So congratulations, first panel. They are responsible for us being here. Before I introduce the panel members, just a little word about process. What we're going to do is, for the first 35 minutes, I'll just ask a broad question every now and then and get the panel's views on those questions. Then I'm sure there'll be people in this audience that have questions of their own, or perhaps comments about this decade that they might want to offer the rest of us. So we'll have a discussion like that. So we'll first hear from the panel members and then throw it open for you to ask your questions or to make a comment yourself. Now I have the real privilege of being able to introduce our panel members. So firstly, yes, it will have to be you. We have Anne Corcoran here. Now, I'm just introducing Anne Corcoran. Anne joined the Child Welfare Office in Education in 1950 when she was appointed a Child Welfare Officer in Whangarei. Over the next 8 years, Anne worked in Timaru, Whakatane and Kaitaia before going to the School of Social Work at Victoria University. There she completed her Diploma of Social Science in 1988. Following that, there was a period where she was the Senior Social Worker in Christchurch and Wellington, and Anne went to the Department of Social Welfare to assume responsibility for foster care and adoption. Whilst in that role, Anne presented papers in foster care and adoption in the UK, Australia and throughout Europe. Anne was also a member of what I now believe is the famous Education and Training Committee, chaired by Ken Daniels, another panel member. And also Anne was a member of the National Exec in 1974. Anne completed her professional career as Director of Catholic Social Services in Wellington, but I understand has been involved in many community activities since. Ken. Coming back. Ken is currently adjunct professor at University of Canterbury in the School of Language, Social and Political Science, but was first appointed to Canterbury in the early 70s to set up the social work degree program there. He was ministerial appointee to New Zealand Social Work Training Council for 7 years and was also acted as the book reviews editor for the Social Work Journal. Ken has undertaken research, counselling and policy development in the field of psychosocial aspects of assisted human reproduction for 40 years, leading to over 140 publications and chapters and books, and he's also written 2 books on the subject. He was Deputy Chair of the Government Advisory Committee on Assisted Reproduction for 12 years and has been advisor to government and government-appointed committees in over 10 countries. Ken's a frequently invited speaker at overseas medical, legal, social worker and patient conferences over the years. Ken was the inaugural chair of the Richmond Fellowship in New Zealand and again chair for 5 years just recently. And most recently, just this year, Ken was made an officer of the New Zealand Order of Merit in recognition for his contribution to health. Now, introducing Anne McCormack, who I'm sure many of you know. Anne trained first as a teacher and started her social work career in a tiny office in Christchurch, then Catholic Social Services. She undertook social work training at Turimoana, which I imagine some of you here also did, and completed the Certificate of Social Work at Canterbury. She was also a member of the famous Education and Training Committee, and in 1980, the then Director of Catholic Services, Catholic Social Services, resigned, and Anne was approached to take up that role. Anne, in fact, became the first lay person to take up a directorship of Catholic Social Services in the country. She continued in that role until 1995. After a year in the DHB, Anne moved into work with residents from Templeton who were relocating into the community. And her particular role there was to work on issues of spirituality and spiritual wellness for those former residents. And so she continued to do that until 2008. Anne is still working in a voluntary capacity in a range of community activities. And finally, Mr. John Fry. His social work career began in the mid-1950s after graduating from Victoria University with a Diploma of Social Science. John started his social work career in the role of a child welfare officer, which he continued to do so for a number of years in different locations. He later moved to work at Anglican Social Services and then on to the Christchurch City Council, where he worked in community development. I have a thank you to Howard Randall. I have a photo of John, which Howard has made for you, John, but we'll pass around the audience. This is John Fry meeting with then Prime Minister of Australia, Bob Hawke. John attended the first meeting of what was to become at that time NZASW. He became president of the association in 1972. John has remained actively involved and interested in the activities of the association up until today. Yeah. So now we have a little thumbnail sketch of each person. It really bears such a little resemblance to the rich amount of work that they've actually done in the community and for the association. I don't want to spend any further time talking, but want to throw it over to the panel. And my first question is to describe to us the context that you believe led to the formation of the association. What was happening at the time? And perhaps I could ask you, Anne, to start.
I haven't a clue.
You haven't a clue? Oh, okay.
Ask someone else and then I'll
chip in.
Well, no, that's silly. I started work in Whangarei. I had hardly heard of Whangarei. I went overseas in my early 20s, and someone said to me, when I got back, I didn't know what I was going to do at all, and a woman called Sheena Reid, who in Invercargill, who some of you all know, had my friend I went overseas with had met her, and she said, "Oh, I was talking to an interesting woman the other day," my friend said, "Sheena Reid, she's a child welfare officer." And as I knew somebody here in Christchurch who was one, I said, "Oh, I'll make some inquiries about that." Well, my friend married the Presbyterian minister in Tapa Nui and I became child welfare officer. But I think, we were a disparate group of people. My feeling is there were only about 100 of us at that stage. I'm not sure. You might remember. But we would just got on with what we had to do. And I think that it was a feeling that there had to be something coherent because, as someone said earlier, our president, I think, was that we needed each other to support ourselves. When I went to work in Whangarei, I left the office on a Monday morning, got home on a Thursday night. And, we worked long hours, we didn't know much about what we were doing. The School of Social Work had started, and the actual School of Social Work, and we needed the bonding of those people and the leadership of those people to come to get an association together. Thank you.
John, do you want to add to that?
Perhaps I could just pick up on that last point that was made. I think right it was very clear that we were a diverse group of people, not seeing a great deal of one another and suffering as a result. And I think an immediate payoff or something that the association made a great contribution by was when it came into existence, it provided a number of opportunities for people in this diverse field really seeing something of one another, and whether it was in small forums of various kinds, I do remember Michael Lyons, the district officer of the Child Welfare Division in Auckland in those days. To his honour, I think he was active in bringing together people in the voluntary and statutory organisations in various ways. They were also meeting up the committees that already has been referenced to today. People met up from across Auckland. I can only speak of the Auckland scene. We met up and had opportunities making really good friendships from people doing similar work. It seems silly to think that we had to wait for that sort of impetus to bring it about. Anyway, it's to the credit of this association, I'm sure that the people in the voluntary, what we now know, but we used to talk about the voluntary organisations, and believe me, they were growing fast in Auckland in those days, and the statutory ones, there was a certain, if you were in the voluntary field, my word, you regarded yourself as working at a slightly different level to the ones in the other field. I might say I think the voluntary people greatly envied the more secure and better salaried, I might say, positions. And I'll stop there.
Well done. Yeah. Well done. Well done. Well
done. I think this is a good moment to bring in the voice of June Kendrick. June Kendrick's not here today, but we are fortunate enough to have a script from June from the research that Barbara Staniford has done. And she did an interview with June, and on this point she says, she was talking about her work, and she said, "I subsequently had two further children." I'll just read what she said. I really had three children under the age of five at one stage. I was rather busy, but I was still interested in the whole process of child welfare, and it was actually in 1962, I think, Professor Min, who was at the Victoria School, came to Auckland or something, and some of us met with him as ex-students, and I really wanted to bring in that Professor Min, because he was quite a figure at that time. Because there were a number of women, Judy McKenzie was one, Janet was the other, Janet McGeorge, were at the same situation. We'd formed a little mothers group. So we knew what was going on, and I remember we discussed the idea, I think, of forming a sort of old students from Victoria, but it actually was Professor Min who I recall very clearly made the point he felt we needed an association. You know, he was obviously quite right. We formed an association in Auckland in 1962. We just rang around the groups we knew who were social workers. It was an interesting group of people, a lot of people from the voluntary sector, and we got it going. That was when I realised a person I'd known briefly, because we'd been at Auckland University at one stage together, Merv Hancock. And Merv was in Dunedin, and we were in Auckland. So I found from Merv that they'd done something similar in Dunedin and organised a study group, a study conference in 1962. So I went to that representing the Auckland group. I think I even gave a paper at it. By 64, of course, 1964, we had our inaugural conference, and the rest was history. I was on the Education Training Committee, and I think, in a way, I looked upon the Social Workers Association as saving me from suburban neurosis. It offered me an outlet. So that's, thank you, Barbara, for giving us June's voice. And on that, on the Education and Training Committee, we have Ken Daniels, who is the chair. So perhaps you'd like to tell us a little bit about the role of that committee and what it meant also for the association.
Yes, thanks, Jane. Tena koutou katoa. When I was younger, I used to recall that people said quite often, "I remember," and it used to irritate me. This is a legitimate time to say, "I remember." And it's quite unique to be able to reflect back on all the different events that have taken place and to see people that I haven't seen for a number of years, although John and I see each other regularly. I also want to acknowledge Merv Hancock. I thought it was marvellous that he was able to make the presentation that he did for us today. If it wasn't for Merv, I wouldn't be here. And Merv was, not now so much, but he was an innovator, a visionary, a galvaniser, an enthusiast. Those are all the words that come to my mind when I think about him. And when I returned from overseas and was working here in Christchurch, he heard of me and organised a seminar in Palmerston North, run by the association, and asked me to come and speak about suicide. I think what he was really doing was looking me over and checking me out. As a result of that, Merv and I developed a professional and personal relationship which was very satisfying to me. And when we worked together for a number of years to develop the Massey University course, and to his credit and with my great admiration, Merv came to me when it had been decided that Massey would begin a course, and he said, "Ken," he said, "you're an obvious person to be appointed to set up this course. I just wanted to let you know that I'm applying for this position so that we know where we stand." By the way, he said, "do you know Canterbury are opening a course as well?" And the die was cast, and I headed to Canterbury, and Merv stayed in Palmerston North. But Merv was an inspirational person, and I think where we are today owes so much to him and the people that he gathered around him, people like ourselves, and the way that he enthused us. Education and training became a focal point for the association during that time. And it was because there was only one course and it had been in operation for a while. But there was a strong feeling that we needed to have more courses of training. And that was partly out of a recognition that social workers needed education and training, that we had power, we had authority, and we needed to exercise that with the best knowledge that was available and with the highest ethical standards that we could maintain. The Education and Training Committee entered or decided on a strategy in which we, I think very cleverly at the time, brought together people from all the different walks of social work in New Zealand. And we asked them to write a statement about the need for education and training. And we gathered these together in a publication. And this became a very significant publication because it represented the workers, the association, the employers, people who had an interest in education and training. And we held a two-day conference in Wellington, and the minister came along and opened that conference. And to cut a long story short, as a result of all of that, the government decided to establish 6 new schools of social work in New Zealand. And the Education and Training Committee and the association were the movers and shakers in relation to that. 3 of those courses were to be in universities and 3 of them to be in polytechnics. Why did that happen? Well, of course, it was the politics. But it was also the questions about professionalism and concern that university training would alienate some people who might not be able to gain access to a university or might not have the ability to complete courses in a university. Well, of course, the polytechs didn't get a look in, as it turned out. The Auckland College of Education was chosen as one of the 6, and Massey, Auckland, and Canterbury were chosen as the other 3. One of the interesting anecdotes, I share 2 anecdotes about that, was that in every meeting virtually that I had with the Vice Chancellor at Canterbury University, Professor Bert Brownlee, he took the opportunity to remind me in not a quiet way, quite strongly actually. He said, "I had the chairman of the University Grants Committee, Sir Alan Danks, come down here, and he sat in this office and he said to me, the government wants you to start university training, education and training for social work. Get on and do it. And he said, we'll supply the money. And Bert's comment was, but he never ever did supply the money. And he felt quite sore about that. The other anecdote that I want to share with you, if I may, was my encounters with the Vice Chancellor at Massey University. And I'm a little bit concerned that this is all being recorded. But Sir Alan Stewart is now dead, so maybe it's a little bit safer to say this. But as chair of the Education and Training Committee, we were lobbying Massey University to start a course. So as chair, I wrote a letter to the Vice-Chancellor, but I didn't think it was appropriate to sign it as chair of the Education and Training Committee, so I sent it up to Auckland, and the then president signed the letter and sent it down to Massey and to Alan Stewart. He got me up and we had a discussion about it, and he said, could you draft a reply, please? Well, you haven't heard it all yet. So I drafted the reply, it went up to him, he sent it to Auckland, they sent it back to me, I drafted another reply. We achieved quite a lot. And I have to say, I didn't find myself arguing with myself either. But those were the days in which we used those kind of informal networking, and we achieved a tremendous amount, I think. And I do also want to acknowledge that the association was very instrumental. Anne, you did the certificate in social studies, social work. The association had lobbied in the absence of full-time professional courses for these certificate courses to be organised. The universities would provide the certificate, but we had 6 months of supervised practice built into that, which the association ran. And the university said, no, we're not getting into that. So, in fact, the association set up the Interim Board of Studies as a way of issuing certificates to people like Anne. And Dougal MacDonald, who was secretary of that board, and myself as chair, signed a number of certificates, one of the most powerful things I ever did in my life, I think. But it was great that, again, the association was taking that very active role.
Thanks, Keith. I think on that note, Anne.
I have clear memories of the starting of the Education and Training Committee in Christchurch, and I only remember yourself and Dougal, who was then called Jan, and you were somewhere up in the clouds as far as I was concerned, because I had come in, I knew absolutely nothing. I was green as green. But of course, they asked me to be secretary. You know, it's always the women who take the minutes. And sometimes I would read the minutes after a meeting and I would think, I don't even know what they were talking about. but it was certainly pioneering days. And yes, I went into that position. I was employed. I had gone teaching, thinking I'd go into child welfare. You know, that was the entree. And then I was encouraged to apply for a job at Catholic Social Services, which had, at that stage, a priest director who was part-time, and he also was the prison chaplain, so, and a part-time volunteer. And I was asked, this is 65, and I was asked to consider applying for this job, which was mostly working with pregnant single women, their partners, and finding homes for their children. And this was the non-statutory sector. And the demand for, in the 1955 Act, Adoption Act, which I think is still current, I can't believe it is, required that a woman or a couple may have only one request about what happened to their child should they place it for adoption, and that was the religion in which it was to be instructed, brought up. And so our association with child welfare was they would ring Catholic Social Services and say, we need a home for this baby. And there were lots of babies, thousands of babies. And so could you find a Catholic home? And when you think about that 50 years ago, I mean, things have changed dramatically, haven't they? I mean, there are no babies, and the religious stipulation really would just not be applicable these days. John made reference to the sort of issue between the non-statutory, the voluntary sector, and the statutory. I think we were always a poor relation. We weren't really well paid, and I know that when I was employed in this job, it was put to me there was no funding, you know, like, come and we'll employ you, but we don't have any funding. So have you got any ideas about how we might get a wage for you? And that was sort of a novel thing, and I think out of that I've learned a lot of things about organisations, but also a lot of things about organising. And it was really interesting because in Christchurch, the Catholic community was quite small. You know, there were 50 parishes, west coast up to Kaikoura and down to Waimate. And we needed the money to pay me, but also we needed the support of people to find foster homes for children, to find holiday homes for children, to find adoptive homes for children. And so one of my tasks was to set out and just go around and visit every kind of Catholic organisation that existed, you know, saying, I'll come and speak, you know, it didn't matter when, how or where. It was often at the end of a working day, and you went out and visited the group, you told them what you were doing, and you encouraged them, one, to give you some financial support, but also to say, here are some of the needs of the day. And it was very interesting, when I think back on it, I can remember I worked with a priest director, Tom Cahill, who was a very compassionate, non-judgmental, kind of liberal thinker. He didn't care much about Rome. And and I always remember coming away from some meetings with him, and we both felt like we were really encouraging promiscuity. What about, and people talked about pregnant women as those girls. Like they were a sort of lepers, and that they had, you know, how on earth did it happen sort of thing? Well, and so there was a lot of educational stuff and a lot of kind of the building of networks and the building of relationships with the wider community, saying, well, this is your social services. If you want it to succeed, you'll need to support it in a whole range of ways. And that's really how the agency grew, so that I think the Catholic Church, and much wider than the Catholic Church, owned it.
because they were participating in it, they were paying it, and we went on, we grew from there. The only other thing I'd like to say around that period was around colleagueship. There was a great deal of ecumenical relationships among the church groups, and that was a very strong network, so that Methodist, Presbyterian, Catholic, Anglican, Salvation Army, Church of Christ were really coming together on a very regular basis and looking at some of the political issues that were facing us, looking at some of the funding issues that were facing us. And that, I think, was a very powerful association and colleagueship that supported us really well. And it wasn't that we weren't having good relationships with our statutory friends through probation and through child welfare and so on, but that was a unique group of people that, you know, came together and shared that, the kind of the church connections, even though we'd had histories that, you know, didn't always lend themselves to, you know, being too cooperative. But in a social service sense, I think there was a lot of cooperation. So
I'll just throw that in.
Yes, Jane, can I just follow up on that? Mm. To reinforce it, there's a photo on one of the early journals from the association which shows the executive of the association. And if you look at priests, nuns, Salvation Army officers, all very active Christians, church people who were very central to the early formation. And Merv Hancock himself is a very active lay reader, preacher in the Methodist Church. So it was a strong influence.
Yes.
And markedly different from today, where the tangata whenua were hardly in any evidence at all. And how great it is that today it is so different.
Interjection, there is two copies of the social work over on that table which will have those photos on.
Yes,
I've got some quite interesting questions here, but I'm also mindful of the time, and I'm wondering if we have some questions or comments already from the floor that people want to raise. Yes.
'73. I don't think I really have a need for that, but it's okay. I don't mind. So I guess my question is, what do you believe were the key needs to engage with Māori whānau? Because I'm hearing across the panel there was a lot of church influence, obviously with a lot of these Anglican, Catholic social services in the day. So that would be my first question. I've got about 150, but I'll start with one.
Well, we'll just have... Who would like to answer that?
I wouldn't mind answering that. I worked in the north twice. I worked in Whangarei for 3 years and in Kaitaia for 3 years. And what did we do? We, when we set out to visit the families, and probably 80% of them at least were Maori families, and they still lived they had very little, and we would have food coupons that we took with us, cars. Our cars had clothes with them. I always remember one of the, Peter Kirk was the first person that I worked with who had a diploma in social work, and he came up from the School of Social Work to Kaitaia and said, "We're not going to take anything out in cars, that's being very patronising." And but he found after about 3 months that that's what the need was there. We did work with the Maori Women's Welfare League quite closely, and there were Maori Women Welfare Officers. The one that I was trying to think of the names today, and one of them that sticks in my mind is we worked very closely. There were only two officers in Kaitaia, and we worked very closely with a woman called Anne Delamere, and a fine woman. I belonged to the Maori Women's Welfare League when I was up there, and we worked in that way, in a very close way with them.
Thank you for that. And I guess we're just so excited in this era today that we have the Tariana Tutias of this world that have introduced whānau ora. So I guess yes, when we look at the era absolutely. From 64 to 2014, what an absolute transformation around working with our Māori whānau now. So thank you. Thank you for doing something for our people, and hopefully we can do better.
I would also like to acknowledge Karu Pukatapu and the Tutangata movement, which I think was very, very powerful and very influential in terms of the association and its movement to where we are today. And his influence was very, very powerful.
One thing I'd throw in here, which reflected the period, the times really, was that the question of adoption, and I look back on it now, and you know, it creates disquiet in me. There were a number of Pākehā women whose babies were fathered by Māori men, and it was never, and often those babies were hard to place, you know, hard to place. And it always made me wonder why those babies were usually adopted by Pākehā families, you know, successfully or unsuccessfully. But we never did the other thing where we asked that a Pākehā child be placed with a Māori family. And that's always sort of, and that was the time that they were the mores, but it's always sort of sat with me in a certain kind of, I felt uncomfortable about it. But that was how it was, and does that make sense to other people who were around at that time? We always expected that a Māori child would be advantaged by being with a Pākehā family, but not in reverse.
I just want to add something to that, because I worked in the North a lot, and I did adoption placements, and I think to the best of our ability we did what we had to do. But then I had to live through an era where the Adult Adoption Act came in, and I was working in head office, and I went to all the select committee hearings on that, and in a way I feel that I learnt so much. I talk about my sins of the early days back to what happened with that, and I feel privileged that I was able to be part of that development of a different way of looking. The open adoptions, the group that were in head office then, we were instrumental in setting that in place. And it was a learning curve, but I think what I also had to face, and I'm sure Anne would agree with it, we did what society expected of us, that's what we have to do, but we also have to move forward as much as we are able to do. And I think that that's what your job is too, to look at what you feel is wrong, not is what you're doing, what you feel is best at this point in time, but in 10 years or 20 years time, how will you know that you will see that there are other ways of doing things. And you can't look back at and have huge regret. You know that as long as you gave it your heart and your intellect and what you know to be in right, then you have to live with that.
John, you've got something.
The mic is yours.
Oh,
yes.
Could I have a chance to pick? I think we've all been very interested in what Ken was able to share with us earlier on. This takes my mind back to that a day I shall never forget in the hall in Auckland in 64, which saw the setting up of this association. There were about half the number of people that we've got today. They were drawn both from the statutory and the voluntary organisations, and by and large it was a pretty good mixture. There was an air of expectation and certainly hope that this association was going to make an impact on our lives. I think the majority of people sitting there that morning hadn't had the advantage of any formal social work education and possibly felt this, they would have seen two lecturers from the Victoria, the newly introduced Victoria University School of Social Work, come to that conference. One was Jim Robb and the other was John McCreary, both of good memory, and they used to come to our conferences regularly. Incidentally, there's no mention yet of that, of our constitution, but if you looked in our constitution, you would see that provision was made. I think it would be a rare thing to find in constitutions of that kind, but there was provision made for the nomination of staffs of university schools of education to go on to join our association. That was a very significant move indeed, because at that time, Tiru Moana was just about to open. Ken, you must help me here. The role of Tiru Moana, it was a bit of a pioneering effort in education. Could you just tell, Tiru Moana was going to take, what, about 20 practicing social workers nominated by their employers and expected to benefit from that course. And one of the, you will be interested to know that the very first resolution of our association was in fact to send a message that we would wish the original 20 people being sent to this, I think, 3-month residential course for people in social work. And we wanted them to be the selectors. We wanted them to be able to choose from the whole field. At that time, it had been announced that this Tiru Moana, an exciting development, was only going to be for the government-employed workers. And here we were taking the opportunity right at the first go of indicating that our organisation was right across the board as far as people's background to that was concerned, and I think that was extremely well received, that perception that here was something that we're going to benefit from. Oh, I could stop there.
I'm sure they will have bought into it.
John mentioned Jim Robb. I just want to say that if you want a feel of what the climate was like in those days, Jim summed it up when he wrote in an article that New Zealand's welfare state was characterised by a kind heart and a cash box. A kind heart and a cash box. And many people said, no need for education and training. That's how you deal with people's problems. Give them money in a caring kind of way, and that will sort it all out.
Well,
and I was at the first course at Tiru Moana, actually. And it was good. There were two. There was Tiru Moana in Wellington, and then there was another one in Auckland. And we did, that was before I ever went to School of Social Work, and we did, it was a great conglomerate of people of every part of the social work field, both the government and the private. And we had some great parties.
I've been given the message, but we've got time. One comment, question.
Talking about that era, that you didn't have
Yes. Yes. Letters. we need to wrap it up there. Just before we do, I want to say I think there's plenty of kind hearts in the room, but not enough cash. And so we've got that, you know, we've got the opposite problem here. I really do want to sincerely thank the panel members who have come to this function today to tell us about the early beginnings of the association. I'm so pleased we are recording this because they are special memories, they are important memories, and we've got them from the people who were actually involved. So please join me in acknowledging that.